Fall cleanup projects around the house can be a lot of work, with leaves to rake, gutters to clean, and wood to stack. But donating that old vehicle you no longer use to NHPR is as easy as pumpkin pie. Free up some space in your garage this autumn, all while supporting the public radio programs you rely on. We'll take care of the paperwork and even arrange to tow away your old car, truck, or boat for free. Learn more today at nhpr.org/cardonation.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The surprise arrival of a package of old letters, photos, and a journal led one New Hampshire man on a search for the uncle he never knew, killed more than 70 years earlier in World War II. This hour on The Exchange, for Veterans Day, we play back for you our 2016 interview with Concord author Paul Levy about his book, Finding Phil, Lost in War and Silence. Paul Levy was a baby when Phil Levy died in 1945, and growing up, his family rarely talked about their loss. But through dogged research, Paul was finally able to tell his uncle's tale, including why Phil was so eager to fight the Nazis and how he died in a lesser-known but critical military campaign that began on the beaches of southern France. Today on The Exchange, one man's World War II story and why it took so long to be told. And listeners, a reminder that this program was recorded earlier, so we can't take any new calls or comments from you. Enjoy the show. Paul Levy, it's really nice to see you. Welcome to The Exchange.
It's great to be here, Laura. I love your show, and it's a real privilege.
Well, what's the bigger story, Paul, that you hope to present with this book through the story of this one person, your uncle, Phil Levy?
Well, you know, initially I didn't expect it to be a story or a book, or I really didn't know what I was getting into. And so the answer to that really comes after the fact. And I think after the fact, what I feel is particularly a message here is about family silences. These stories that I tell are wrapped in this notion of family silences. The prologue is and the epilogue are sort of wrapping around these stories. A lot of families are silent about people who were killed in the war, or even with soldiers who come back, they're silent and their stories aren't told. And it's I think, so important that we hear these stories and find these stories. I can talk maybe later a little bit about the impact on me from learning these stories and a bit on my family, but it's profound.
Learning them so late in the game. I mean, nobody talked about Phil when you were growing up.
No, absolutely. I knew, you know, four or five facts about him. I knew he played the drums, and I knew he went to the University of Michigan, and I knew he was married, and, you know, maybe four or five things, and that's it. You know, I didn't know more.
Well, I can't tell you how many people have said to me, Paul, something similar to what you just said. Oh, my uncle fought. Oh, my father fought. Oh, my, you know, my brother-in-law fought. Never talks about it. Never says anything about it. And those are the guys who came back. Your story is even tougher because Phil Levy didn't come back.
Yeah, that's right. I've heard stories both ways. You know, I start telling my story a little bit to people, and within minutes, they're connecting to a similar kind of story in their life with respect to somebody who came back or didn't come back. And, of course, family silences hide a lot of other kinds of things in lives, too.
Well, and again, that's the subtitle of the book, Finding Phil, Lost in War and Silence. What's that silence about, Paul? I mean, is it generational? Is it because it's just too hard? Would we be this silent today? What do you think?
You know, I wish I knew more of an answer to this.
Yeah.
But, you know, part of it is that's a way to handle grief. And another might be that people don't want to burden other generations with that grief or with the expectations maybe that they had for this young person who was killed. I'm not sure, but silences are difficult things for the people who carry them. For those of us who never hear the stories, there's just sort of a void. And when we start to hear the stories, we begin to realize what we've missed.
Well, and again, if you're listening to us this hour, we're talking about Finding Phil, Lost in War and Silence with author Paul Levy. And if you're relating to some of the things he's saying about family silences, especially around those who were lost in this war, World War II? Join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Paul, you said growing up, you know, you knew a couple facts about Phil. He played the drums. He went to University of Michigan, you said, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Jumping ahead a lot. Uh-huh. Here it is, the late 1980s. You suddenly receive a package after all these years of family silence about this beloved lost uncle. What's in the package?
Well, a note that says Barbara died and Gil thought she wanted you to have these. And the two items in the package were a Purple Heart that belonged to Phil. I didn't know anything about an award of a Purple Heart to him. And a 96-page handwritten journal that he had kept for about 12 days of the war when he was taking part in the invasion of southern France. And I knew who Gil was. Gil was Barbara's then husband. And, of course, I knew who Phil was. And Barbara was Phil's wife, his wife of 3 days before he headed off to war. They had been in love and decided to get married before he headed out.
And that was probably not an untypical story, Paul, right? Of people getting married real quickly, lots of passion, and then I have to go, and married 3 days.
Three days. And, you know, there are letters where he felt guilty about this and wondered if they should have done it. And they obviously talked a lot about it, but they decided to do that.
A lot of people did that,
yeah.
I'm thinking,
yeah.
In that era. So how did you feel when you got this thing?
Well, surprise, certainly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was busy with life. This is what happens with many of these situations. But I was pretty busy with life. I glanced through the journal. It's a fascinating journal. It allowed me to not just learn some things about Phil, but to learn who he was, to get a sense of his character. And but I set it on the shelf and said maybe someday when I get some time, I'll try to find out more. And I didn't get that time until I retired and picked up the journal and began to do some research.
I wonder why Barbara thought that you were the guy.
Well, you know, I knew Barbara a bit. I remember her as a kid coming back once in a while to the family, but I knew her when I was in Indianapolis for 10 years because that's where she was, and we met a couple of times. But, you know, we didn't talk about Phil. She just sensed somehow maybe that that I would be interested or, you know, she probably didn't know where to hand these things. She had a family that she had developed with, another husband, and that wasn't the right place, I guess, and somehow I was as right a place as she could find.
Well, there's those family silences again.
Yeah, that's right.
She was effectively your aunt because they were married briefly before he was shipped off and killed. You did know her, got together occasionally, but you didn't talk about him. I find that so amazing.
And what's also amazing as I look back is I never asked about him. You know, I had begun to observe this family silence. I don't think it was just that I was, you know, a young kid and you don't have that much interest in ancestors at that point. I think it was partly that I had become enwrapped in this family silence too.
Well, again, today in The Exchange, our guest is New Hampshire author Paul Levy. His brand new book is called Finding Phil, Lost in War and Silence. It's about Paul's quest to uncover the life and death of an uncle he never knew, who died in World War II in a campaign, by the way, that not as many Americans may know about, but was very critical to American successes in the war. Join us with your comments, questions, your own stories about your own family's experience with this war. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Paul, let's jump into this story, and it's an amazing story. Your Uncle Phil enlists early for war service. He does not wait around. How come?
Well, he's a youngster when he heads off to college. He's 17 years old, and he enters college in September of 1939. That's the month that World War II started. Germany invaded Poland. And he opts for a curriculum that includes ROTC and some military courses and that will take him into the Army at the end of his graduation. And You know, and I wondered why he made that choice, and I tried to understand it. And I think there are a number of reasons, but certainly a part of it was he was well aware of what was going on with Jews in Europe. And he was bothered by that a great deal because of his story that he was well aware of with his father escaping Russia and tyranny in Russia.
Yeah, your family's history is similar to that of many Jews in America, pogroms in Eastern Europe against the Jews, and so they escape and come to America and build a successful life.
Yeah, exactly. And then Phil was a debater, and in the debates at the time, many of them had to do with things that were evolving with respect to the draft or this looming war or helping out Europe during the war. And he was quite aware of where things were, I think. And he felt, we're going to go to war. And this is a war that I want to be in, I think. And so at the age of 17, he opted for that path. And he continued. Upon his graduation, after 3.5 years, he headed to Fort Knox and was trained as a tank commander.
Well, and it's interesting. There's a clash for him, right? You know, he's Jewish. He's really wants to stick it to the Nazis, obviously. He's a French major in college, hopes to use his French skills in the war, which he does, but he finds some unattractive French attitudes towards Jews once he's over there.
Yeah, he ran into a bit of anti-Semitism, and I gained a little sense of that from a few of the incidents that he mentions. He doesn't mention many. I have more of a sense of that from some other books that I read. There's a wonderful book called G.I. Jews that talks to—
G.I. Jews.
G.I. Jews. And it's a bunch of interviews with World War II vets who came back, Jewish vets in the New York and New Jersey area, who talk about their experiences. And they ran into quite a bit of anti-Semitism. Phil might have. I just don't know all of that. But they also ran into some wonderful interreligious things, too. I mean, there are some amazing stories on both directions with respect to that.
Well, and just judging from letters that you include in the book, when he is confronted with these anti-Semitic attitudes— he doesn't say anything. He doesn't say, hey, by the way, I'm Jewish, stop.
Yeah, that's right. You know, he just sort of shrugs off one time with a slur, a Jewish slur. And another time he does take it on in his mind, but he isn't speaking out. He's holding back on those things.
Again, the phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. So for American soldiers hating the Nazis, obviously that's a common theme, and Phil had that extra passion because of what the Nazis were doing to the Jews. Here's one letter that Phil sent home on August 18th, where he describes the capture of a German general who is being taken to headquarters. And in this letter, we get a little sense of how much he really hates the German army and the Nazis. Thanks, by the way, to NHPR's Peter Biello for this reading of Phil Levy's letter.
GIs were starting to congregate around the prisoner. There were some officers in the vicinity. I looked on for a moment. A GI was about to offer a prisoner a cigarette, and another was trying to communicate. I stepped over and in a low voice said, "Don't you men know that it is against the policy of our government to permit fraternization with prisoners of war?" The crowd just melted away, and some of the GIs looked at me with their mouths hanging open. Besides our government's policy, these were the bastards who wounded Hernandez and Hecht and who killed and wounded many civilians the night before by indiscriminate bombs. I could have killed the general and his orderly very easily. I have no conscience when it comes to these German soldiers.
Again, thanks to Peter Biello for that reading of Phil's letter. What comes up for you, Paul, hearing Peter read that?
Well, that was quite a moment. Phil trained as a tank commander, but for the first year he was used as a translator because he knew languages well, French and other languages, and he worked for headquarters in various ways with some strange assignments. And this was one of the strange assignments. And he had other strange assignments with respect to this. Five German generals were captured in the first day or two of this invasion of southern France. He had to find hotel spaces for three of them. And this was not a comfortable thing for him to do.
Wait, he had to find hotel spaces for German generals?
Yeah, they were put up in hotels.
Well, you can tell from that letter he's not happy about it.
No, he has a job to do, and he's doing that job, but he's doing it with all this passion bubbling beneath it.
Well, and he also writes in his letters and in his journal, he's itching for combat. Kind of understand this is what he signed up for, is to fight the Germans. He finally got it in what was called Operation Dragoon. Now, I'm a little embarrassed to say, I know a fair bit about World War II. I had not heard about this, Paul.
Yeah, I guess it's not a well-known battle. Here's the situation. Eisenhower's plan for invading Europe was starting with Normandy, essentially. And, we all know about the Normandy invasion.
Everybody knows
June
about that.
June 1944. But he had a second invasion in mind in southern France, this Dragoon invasion that happened 2 months later. And and incidentally, Churchill opposed that invasion, and Eisenhower won that discussion. And the idea was that the southern troops would land and move north to meet the Normandy troops. They would form a north-south line in France and then start moving east across Belgium. The Normandy troops were up in the Belgian area and through the rest of France for these southern Dragoon troops. And into Germany and to Berlin and victory. And, you know, with a couple of hiccups along the way, that's essentially what happened.
And we've got a map on our website if people want to look more at that. But, again, a lot of people don't know about this. There was this whole idea, as you say, you know, come in from the beaches of Normandy, from the west, and then from the south, and then you form this big line, and then you push the Nazis back into Germany. Why don't more people know about this Operation Dragoon?
I don't know. I didn't know. You know, I only had this reason to begin to figure that out. I was going to try to find out where Phil was killed because I didn't know. I knew it was somewhere in France, and I started following troop movements. And in the process of following troop movements, I came across the fact that he was in Operation Dragoon, and I had to learn about it. Yeah, we don't learn too much about the war, and certainly I didn't know anything like the strategy that Eisenhower has followed, a very sort of straightforward strategy that worked.
And the name Dragoon is because Churchill felt dragooned into it, right? Like, he didn't want to do this.
That's at least the story for how that got the name, because its original name was Anvil.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Paul, a little bit more about this Operation Dragoon. Again, everybody's seen or heard these, you know, sort of hyped-up newsreels about the Normandy invasion, but it took us a little while to find some of this about this southern invasion. Again, southern France, those beautiful beaches along the Riviera. We did manage to find, though, a little audio, courtesy of the National Archives, of the invasion of southern France, this Operation Dragoon that your Uncle Phil participated in. Let's hear.
H hour. Guns of the fleet opened up, and the invasion of southern France began. Landing craft bearing men, tanks, and ammunition raced toward their objectives. American PT boats vanguarded the invasion. Transports released their cargoes. Some assault boats were lowered empty into the sea. Others were fully loaded. As these landing craft headed for the shore, there could be no turning back. The roar of the fighting planes, the booming of the big guns, and the rockets zooming overhead created a never-to-be-forgotten inferno.
Again, that's some newsreel footage, courtesy of the National Archives, of this lesser-known southern France invasion, Operation Dragoon. Paul Livy is our guest this hour. The new book that he wrote, Finding Phil, Lost in War and Silence, it's about his uncle, who ultimately died in that campaign. Phil, Paul, you looked at a lot of video, audio, archival footage, and so forth about this Operation Dragoon. What else did you find out about it?
Well, it was a very interesting campaign. You know, Normandy had just happened 2 months before with the tremendous casualties that we took and the fierce fighting and we gained the beachhead, and then we were stuck on that beachhead for 5 or 6 weeks before they could break out and begin to move south a little and take Paris. And the Dragoon armada, 900 ships that were part of this armada for the invasion, didn't know what they were in for. You know, they were thinking maybe it's going to be the same kind of thing. But instead, I mean, there was certainly fierce fighting, and that newsreel begins to suggest that. But the beachhead was established very quickly in a day or two, and they were ready for breaking out right after that. They didn't run into anywhere near the resistance that the Normandy troops had run into. And they began to push the Germans very rapidly up the Rhone River Valley in what became known as the Champagne Campaign. Champagne because it went smoothly, like champagne, in part because it was through Champagne country, and in part because in every town that was liberated, every little town, they would toast the soldiers with champagne. And tens of thousands of Germans were captured during this, and I don't know how many were killed, but they kept retreating and retreating, and we moved very quickly, the several hundred miles up to where the Normandy troops were at that point. The Germans eventually were going to hole up in the Vosges Mountains along the Rhine River, where they felt they could establish a really strong foothold and hold off our army. And that's where they headed, and were safely there by September of 1944, when our southern troops met the northern troops and formed this line that I talked about.
So in contrast to Normandy, first of all, Normandy's first, so it happened in June, so more people know about it because of that. Also, perhaps this Operation Dragoon is lesser known, Paul, because it went so easily at first. It just kind of, you know, floated up into France and did okay.
Yeah, possibly. And certainly a lot of attention continued to be on Normandy. You know, that was a devastating battle. Most of the reporters were probably up there. Most of the Signal Corps people who were making these newsreel films and others, they were probably covering that much more than in the South. I'm not sure, but Dragoon got lost in the shuffle.
What does Phil write about Dragoon, especially in those early days? What sort of sense of that campaign does he give you? He's nervous at first, and then it starts to go pretty well.
Yeah, I don't know too much. You know, he wrote this journal, and it covered mostly the time when he was aboard the ship heading to Dragoon. He had lots of leisure time for a few days, and then they had to begin to prepare for the invasion, and the journal changes. And then there are a couple of days where he scribbled notes on what happened ashore. And he was in his first gunfights. You know, he had worked behind the lines, and he would soon be working behind the lines again. But for a few days, he was battling the Germans. And I just have a little sense of that, and not much more. A few things through letters as to what happened as he moved forward. I do know that when these lines met, when the Dragoon troops met the Normandy troops in September 1944. Phil writes that assignments changed and I'm left without a job, and he's angry about that. And he's not happy with the way he's been used up to then. I want to be at the front, I want to be fighting, or send me home. And there's a letter that really is a vicious letter. And
about how he's not being used. Yeah. We'll pick up on that in just a minute, Paul. More in just a moment with Paul Levy on his book, Finding Phil, Lost in War and Silence. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new book by a New Hampshire author called Finding Phil, Lost in War and Silence. We're sitting down with the writer, Paul Levy. It describes his search to uncover the life and death of an uncle he never knew who died in World War II. Again, the exchange number for you to join us with your comments, questions, if you have similar stories to Paul Levy's, 1-800-892-6477. Or if you just want to know more about this Operation Dragoon that Paul's uncle was involved in, a lesser-known campaign that came 2 months after Normandy, that, as we've been learning, hooked up with the Normandy troops and tried to push the Germans back into Germany. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Paul, we got an email here from Lisa in Whitefield. She says, it's interesting to hear about the silence. We talked about that earlier, Lost in War and Silence. Lisa says, my mother Louise was in World War II as a nurse. Her unit spent some time at a concentration camp in Austria, taking care of the survivors after the camp was liberated. Wow, Lisa. Lisa says, I remember going to this camp's memorial when I was very young. However, she never really spoke about her experience and the horrors she saw until later in life. She always said she just felt she was doing her job. Lisa, thank you so much for that email. What do you think about that, Paul?
It's wonderful that she spoke up later in life, you know, and that Lisa has that story. I wish more of that had happened. And you know, it can still happen a bit. There are still some people from that era. And if you have anyone in your family in that situation, I urge you strongly, talk to them immediately, ask them questions, see if they want to talk. If they don't want to talk, they won't. But many later in life begin to want to share those stories. I ran into numbers of those sharings. That's a very nice story, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa, so much for the email. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You know, Lisa mentions talking to her mother later in life. You had a little roadblock with this, Paul, because by the time you started working on this book, a lot of the people who knew your uncle were dead.
Almost all were, you know.
Did you find anybody?
Well, you know, his younger sister was still living at that time and still sharp. And I talked with her and I gained some information. But, you know, I think the family silence had either erased memories for her or I'm not quite sure why she didn't have more to tell me, but she had some. And that was helpful. And then she dug into some of her letters and things that were also helpful. But I didn't know really anyone else who knew Phil. And I would find a couple people in the process of my research.
Well, tell us about those people, because they were, I think you found one gentleman who actually knew Phil on the boat, right? On that Operation Dragoon?
That's a little bit different story. But I found two people who knew Phil well. One was his best friend at college.
Wow.
And this guy was pretty deep into Alzheimer's at the time, and I called him and talked with him, and he didn't remember, and then suddenly he remembered some things, and he gave me a statement of what Phil had meant to him, and it's just very moving. It was a moving conversation, and Mark Van Aken is the person's name. Named his only child, his son, Philip Albert, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
There's another wonderful story. You know, if you're wondering how to dig some of these things up, I happen to, there are unit groups of many of the units that fought in the war. And there was is 191st Tank Battalion unit that still has some people connected. And I called, a guy who had done their newsletter for a while, and he was a veteran of the unit. He was out in Ohio, and I started talking to him. Anyway, in the course of a few discussions with him, he thought there might be somebody that he knew of that might have known Phil, might have fought with Phil. And I
In that tank battalion.
And it turns out that this guy was the gunner, the assistant gunner in Tank 2 behind Phil's. But I called this guy out of the blue in Long Island, and you know, I said, you know, I'm Paul Levy, I'm the nephew of Phil Levy, and I understand from Dennis Berger that you know you might have known Phil and fought with him. And this guy, this is 70 years after, and he's a 90-year-old guy. He said, sure, I remember Phil, and wasn't his wife's name Barbara?
Wow, that's amazing.
And then he went on to we talked for a little while. And he says, I'll be back in a second. And he leaves the phone for about 20 seconds. And he comes back, and he has grabbed a letter that obviously was near at hand. And he says, this is a letter that I sent home to my mom back at that time. And I eventually got a copy of this letter. And in it, he says, you might have noticed that my commanding officer is Phil Levy from South Bend, Indiana. By far the swellest guy I've met in the Army. What a moving thing to suddenly come across when you know nothing, you know, a few months earlier, knew nothing about your uncle. It was very moving, and I became good friends with Jack Del Monte and visited a few times, and we'd talk every month or so, and Jack died a couple of months ago, which was a sad thing for me.
What a gift. What a gift he gave you.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Well, you talked earlier, Paul, about this Operation Dragoon, again, that ultimately took your uncle's life, you know, again, hitting the beaches in southern France, moving up with the goal of pushing the Germans back into Germany. And as you described, it went pretty well at first. You know, they moved at the beaches. They call it the Champagne Campaign, partly because they moved through the area of Champagne, partly because it was smooth like Champagne. But then the troops, including Phil, of course, got stuck in some tough warfare in eastern France, in Alsace-Lorraine. Now, to help people picture this, we put a map on our website. But this is the province right on the German border with the Rhine River. So once you cross the river, you're in Germany. One writer called the fighting there like jungle warfare, deep woods, lots of snow. Here's how Phil describes it in a letter he wrote back home on Christmas Day, 1944. And again, this is read by NHPR's Peter Biello.
My life here is pretty rugged. It's colder than hell, and the tanks are like refrigerators, with quarter inch of frost on the outside. Just came back from inspecting my outposts. Nothing new. Carried another GI back. Artillery barrage. Damn shame. Christmas Eve, too. I've been bazooka'd, panzerfausted, hit mines, done everything a man can do. But I've been extremely lucky. I've seen every type of combat, woods, city fighting, river crossing, etc. My last tank to be knocked out was hit by two APs. I can still smell the burning metal. Driver got his left arm taken off and a hole straight through his right groin. Assistant driver badly beat up. The rest of us came out okay. I'll be glad to see the end of this war.
And you know, Paul, in fragments from the journal, in letters like that that you share in the book, you see this very quick shift for your uncle, you know, from a couple months before where he's like, I can't wait to fight and I'm tired of just, you know, running errands for people and being a courier and a translator. So he gets his wish. He starts fighting. And very quickly he says, as we heard at the end of that letter, I can't wait for this to be over. It's horrible.
Absolutely. You know, let me put a little bit of context around this, too.
Around that Christmas Day letter?
Around that letter. A couple of days before then, he had just written home to his parents, telling them, everything's fine, I'm great, I had my first shower in a month, I'm growing a mustache, I'm fit, I'm healthy, I just got a care package from home. And this other letter was to his brother-in-law, who was serving in the Army stateside over here in this country, and he can be straight with Herm. So the stories that went home were very different stories around his experiences, and neither of those letters would get back to South Bend before they would get the news that Phil had been killed.
So they got the news that he'd been killed, and then they got these letters from him.
I think so.
And getting back to this theme of silence, again, you know, he sends one letter home a couple days before Christmas. I'm great. I think he closes it out by saying, I'm ridiculously healthy or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But then to the brother-in-law, he says, this is horrible. I can't wait till it's over. That's his own silence. He created his own silence for mom and dad.
He knew that they were worrying at home, and he didn't want them to worry, and that's the way he dealt with it. And almost all soldiers, I think, did the same thing. I think they wrote that kind of letter home.
Let's go back to our listeners, Paul. Again, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ray's joining us from Londonderry. Hi, Ray. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Fascinating story. I just thought I'd relate a somewhat similar experience as briefly as I can. My own father died when I was 12. He fought all through the Pacific War as a Marine.
Wow.
Through a curious set of circumstances a few years ago, I was able to locate a man, actually through his son, who's a United Airlines pilot, who served in the same outfits, been in the same battles, and in fact, who had been decorated for evacuating wounded under fire and was recommended by the chaplain who later solemnized my parents' wedding in 1948. I managed to get in touch with him. He's old now, Parkinson's so bad that he needs assistance on the phone. But he related all the stories the names of the nicknames they had for their officers, which weren't too kind.
Or at least not for a radio program, right?
No, I won't.
Yeah.
No. I don't say them to anybody. Then I said, well, what was my father like to serve with? And I still recall what he said. He was a good shipmate. Now, I'm not going to say he had a chip on his shoulder, but he really knew his onions and was not the least bit reluctant to tell anybody when he thought they were screwing up, including officers. And I mentioned that brief bio to my wife, who just smiled and said, I know someone just like that.
she talking about you, Ray?
Yes, she was.
Wow.
Yeah, shortly after I'd been captain of the ship. But anyhow, it was a real stroke of grace to have been able to talk to somebody after so many years, because, of course, my father never talked about the war except some of the funny stories. And I know that he had, he didn't call it PTSD back then, but he had it.
Well, Ray, it's so good to hear from you. And wow, I mean, what a thing to lose his dad at age 12. And all those stories are lost. And he was lucky enough, like you were, Paul, excuse me. we keep talking Paul and Phil, to find somebody who remembered.
Yeah, that's a great story, and one to really pass on to the rest of your family. And golly, that's a nice one.
Yeah, Ray, thank you so much for calling in. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Cindy sent us an email. She says, I know that in my mother's generation, born in the Depression, there were many taboo topics: mental illness, unwanted pregnancy, adoption, marital problems, criminal records, as well as war service experiences. Cindy says, even as a child, I knew, just don't ask. So that's where the silence comes from, too.
Yeah.
And then compounded by, you know, extreme grief over the loss of a son. So
yeah, right. And you learn not to ask, and it becomes habitual, and questions never get asked.
Well, Cindy, thank you for the email. And Ray, thank you again so much for the call. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Paul, Phil was a tank commander. And I was interested to learn from your book. Again, there's so much in here that I didn't know before, not just about this Operation Dragoon, not just about that intense winter fighting in eastern France, in Alsace-Lorraine, in the Vosges Mountains, but that the American tanks weren't very good. The Sherman tanks, that's kind of an iconic image, but you write and you learn that they had some problems. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, they had some problems. They were good. The German tanks were very heavy and powerful.
Panzers, right?
Could put a hole through a Sherman easily, and Shermans would fire at Panzers and the shot would bounce off, because they were Shermans were medium weight tanks and much smaller. To get that many across the ocean, they had to be lighter, and so they made them very maneuverable, and they were wonderful, and they were quick, but they weren't as powerful as the Panzers. So they had to be used in different ways, but the design allowed for when they were hit, they would very quickly go up in flames, typically. They were called Ronsons, after the Ronson lighter by the Englishman, and Tommy Cookers was a name that the Germans called them. And
Tommy Cookers, because the British troops were called Tommies?
Yeah, that's right. The Shermans were used by the British as well. We supplied them with these tanks. The American tank men called them Purple Heart boxes. If they were hit, you had to either get out of them very quickly. You had like 3 seconds to get out of them before they might go up in flames. Not they didn't always, but they often did. That was one of the big difficulties with Shermans. They kept perfecting Shermans over the course of the war, too, and I suppose they worked on that feature of it.
So they had to be made of lighter weight material because they had to be shipped overseas from America to Europe.
Flown, or often, or shipped. Yeah, I don't know that full story, but the lightness of the weight allowed more of them to be brought over more quickly.
Well,
and 50,000 of these were manufactured during the course of the war. 50,000, that's a lot of them.
Okay, I kind of found this maddening because your uncle died in one of these tanks and people knew about the design flaws. I mean, Tommy cookers. I mean, it doesn't get more, you know, accurate than that or chilling than that. Here's what Phil's new commanding officer, Major Wellborn G. Dolvin, wrote about these Sherman tanks. Major Dolvin says, the Sherman tank is no match for the German Mark IV, V, or VI. On numerous occasions, hits were obtained on German tanks with no noticeable results. On the other hand, German high-velocity tank guns never fail to penetrate the Sherman tank. This situation has a tremendous effect on the morale of tank crews. This was evidenced by reluctance of crews to fire on German tanks, feeling that it would do no good, right, because their tanks are so good, and would result in their being promptly knocked out. Crews soon became ultra-cautious when German tanks were in the vicinity. Again, that's a quote from Phil's commanding officer, Major Wellborn G. Dolvin. So there's a whole psychology going on. The guys, including your uncle, knew these tanks.
Yeah.
Had big problems.
And Dolvin was one of the outspoken critics of some of this, and probably some of the things that he said led to innovations in the design of Shermans, but there was this problem.
Well, and that's the problem that killed your uncle, right?
No, I think he would have been killed anyway by what happened. But that story's down the road a little bit. Should I pick up and try
Go ahead,
to
sure.
move to that? You know, we left Phil not knowing where
Horrible
he was going to be assigned.
Horrible fighting in the Vosges Mountains,
and he gets assigned to the 191st Tank Battalion, and he reports, and they're in the Vosges Mountains. They're just getting into the Vosges Mountains where the Germans have holed up. And this is October 16th, 1944. And so, you know, I had started out trying to find where in France my uncle had died, and at least I knew that he was in the Vosges, and I know that they didn't get out of the Vosges until February or March of 1945, so he died somewhere in the Vosges, and I kept moving forward. And about this time, I got some records that I had sent away for. I sent away for his personnel file, and I found that that had been burned in a fire in 1973 in the St. Louis repository that destroyed most of the personnel files of most World War II vets.
Okay, so hang on. That's upsetting because here you are trying to get the records and they are burned in a fire. Hold on with that, Paul. We'll be back in a moment. More with Paul Levy in just a minute. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new book by a New Hampshire author called Finding Phil, Lost in War and Silence. Writer Paul Levy describes his search to uncover the life and death of an uncle he never knew who died in World War II. Let's hear from you, your questions and comments about this war, about relatives you may have lost, or about this silence that Paul writes about. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Paul, so here's Phil, this Operation Dragoon, you know, goes pretty well for a couple months, but now it's winter. He's stuck with his group. He's a tank commander. He's stuck in the Vosges Mountains in eastern France. The goal ultimately is to push the Germans back over the Rhine River, back into Germany and follow them. But it's a tough winter of fighting. So go ahead and pick that up.
It's a very tough winter. And they're pushing the Germans north. In the Champagne campaign, they were moving miles a day, pushing the Germans back. Here, they're lucky if they push 100 yards.
Wow.
And we heard the description of some of what this was like. And I was continuing my search for where he might have died. And I got the second set of things. I didn't get anything from the personnel records because they had been burned. But I got unit records from the 191st Tank Battalion, and I was amazed at how detailed they were, day by day, casualty reports, reports on the fighting that went on. And there was a telephone log of calls, excuse me, that went into headquarters. And I quickly moved to that and went to January 7th, 1945, and looked down the list of calls, and a call came into Commander Dolvin that said, Phil Levy and entire crew killed in action. And, you know, I'd known for 70 years that Phil was dead, but this was like getting the official notice of it, like, you know, hearing the knock at the door and reading the telegram. And that was a very moving moment. And after I regained my composure, I looked back at this entry, and it said, "Near Wingen," W-I-N-G-E-N. So I didn't know where Wingen was, and I went and found it. And there are two Wingens. There's a Petty Wingen, Little Wingen, and there's a Wingen Sir Motor. And both would actually play very important parts in Phil's military career. One was the high point of his career, and one was where he was killed.
He was killed when his tank was fired upon. Is that correct?
No, not exactly. Should I tell the story
Sure.
a bit of the battle? So I learned that there was a major battle at Wingen, at Wingen Sir Motor. And it was a battle in the last offensive of Hitler called Northwind.
And again, this is something that not a lot of people know about. I mean, until
yeah.
I read this book, I had not heard of this battle in the increasingly desperate, you know, last days of the Hitler regime.
Yeah, we've heard of another offensive, the Ardennes Offensive, which pushed the northern
sure.
Normandy troops back into a bulge that became the Battle of the Bulge, and fighting to regain that line was, of course, in most history books.
Very famous.
Northwind, Hitler was very excited by his progress at that initially, and he set up the second effort, Northwind, to try to push a bulge in the southern, the Dragoon troops line in the Vosges.
Where your uncle was.
Where my uncle was. And one of the battles, a major battle in that, was the Battle of Wingen. And there's a lot written about it, and I started reading books. So, I had closed in on where my uncle was killed. And as I read, the Battle of Wingen began on January 3rd, when some crack German troops came in and overwhelmed the new American troops who hadn't even seen battle, who were defending Wingen at the time, and they threw the Americans in the Catholic Church.
That's right. They put them in there as prisoners, locked them up in this little Catholic church.
That's
There's a picture
right.
of it in the book.
Yeah. I would visit that church as well. And then the Americans brought in some more forces and started fighting back and made progress. And on the 7th of January, they were ready to move in for the final battle and to take back Wingen, and they found that the Germans had escaped that night. So there was no fighting on the 7th. Now, of course, that was mysterious to me. If there was no fighting on the 7th and my uncle was killed, how was he killed? And I would find an answer to that. I found the answer in a book that was about the Battle of Wingen called 7 Days in January. And the title interested me, and the 7 days were January 1st to January 7th.
When he died.
And it turns out that the person who wrote that book, the 7th was the end of the war for him too, but in a different way. He was captured. And you know how you can go to Amazon and look inside a book? And I went and looked inside this book, and the first words that begin this book are referring to the 7th of January. "Behind me, a tank is burning." And I knew that the 191st had only lost one tank on the 7th of January, Phil's tank. And I knew that he was referring to my uncle's tank.
This author, who, by the way, was a German officer, right?
He was a German officer, a Waffen-SS officer, who was the commander, one of the two commanders of the troops in Wingen, and he had written a book about the Battle of Wingen from the standpoint of their strategy, and had worked closely with the commander, Cheves, Wallace Cheves, who was the commander of the American troops, in verifying some of his facts and understanding the American strategy in that war. It's a very interesting book and a well-written book. So I read further and got the book and read further and began to learn a lot more about my uncle's death.
So through this book, written by a German Waffen-SS, you learned how your uncle died.
Yes, I did.
The tank that he describes as burning is your uncle's tank.
That's right.
So you not only discovered where and how your uncle died, you discovered who killed him.
Well, that's the next piece of the story.
As this guy, Wolf Zepf
led his troops out of town and up through the snow, and they're exhausted, and they move up to the ridge and by going across country to avoid confrontation with the American outposts. And he gets to the ridge. They turn down the forest road, and a quarter of a mile down, they come to a hulking thing in the road, and all of his soldiers ahead of him are edging by this, thinking that they're now near safety because they're trying to get back to the German lines, which aren't very far away. And suddenly the turret gun begins to turn toward his troops. And
that's your uncle's tank?
That's my uncle's tank.
Okay, go ahead.
And Wolf Zepp leaps on the tank and pops open the turret door and drops his last grenade in the tank. So from knowing somewhere in France to knowing this story of exactly where
and when how, and who and who, how
was quite a journey.
The who is the most chilling part, I think, for me.
It was very chilling.
There's a picture, by the way, in the book of this.
I've got
this
pictures of him because I started
Wolf
to
Zepp.
Learn. I got interested in more in Wolf Zepp for certain reasons, and I have some pictures of him.
And we put one picture up on our website as well. Again, if folks want to look, there's a picture of Uncle Phil. There's a picture of this Wolf Zepp and a picture of the map of this Operation Dragoon. Again, this much lesser known battle that Phil fought in. What was it like to learn about this Wolf Zepp? I mean, in one sense, you say in the book, I can't blame him. He only did to Phil what Phil was about to do to him.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't upset with that. Sure he killed Phil, but this was war, and Phil was about to fire at his 200 men that he was marching out of Vingen, and he did the only thing he could think of, but there was. I learned more about Wolf Zepp, and in the book is printed in the United States by Abergeona Press, an interesting book.
Wolf's book, yeah.
Wolf's book. And the foreword to it is by a Brigadier General Metaxas and by another foreword by another soldier, the editor of the paper. Both of them fought in the Vosges Mountains against Wolf Zepp and others. And they had some interesting things to say about Wolf.
This is the exchange on NHPR. So what did they say about him, Paul?
Well, they had met him at some reunions. There were several reunions of German and American veterans.
Where they got together.
Where they got together. And, you know, this happened numbers of times, sort of amazingly.
It is amazing.
Yeah, I would eventually meet with the people who helped put the American side of that together. And Wolf Zepp helped put the German side of this together a bit. And in this book that these two people had written forewords or introductions or something to the book, they had gotten to meet Zepp, and they refer to him as a particularly humanitarian person.
The guy who dropped a grenade into your uncle's tank.
Who's a Waffen-SS officer. Now, the Waffen-SS, if you don't know, were Hitler's special troops. They did many of the evil deeds for Hitler. They ran the concentration camps. They fomented the outbreaks against Jews. They did many of the evil things in concentration camps and other things. And at Nuremberg, when many of the individual Nazis were tried and condemned for war crimes, the Waffen-SS was tried as a group. And not only was it condemned for its war crimes as a group, every individual in it was considered a war criminal because the acts of atrocities were so pervasive across units and individuals that Nuremberg felt, that the judges at Nuremberg felt they could condemn all of them as criminals.
They couldn't just pick one guy out as a good guy and one guy out as a bad guy.
That's right. And so that's my image of Waffen-SS folks, and that's the Nuremberg image. And suddenly I'm confronted with this notion that one of them is a humanitarian.
How would you advise somebody listening today, Paul, who wanted to uncover what you uncovered about a relative who died in the war? I mean, we've talked earlier about how hard it is to get stories out of those who made it home. What about somebody who didn't make it home? There were so many.
Well, I sure didn't have any clues as to how to move forward.
Yeah.
But, you know, let me just, I can mention some of the things that went on. I'll just sort of tick them off. very quickly. But you do the obvious things. You try to gather letters and family memorabilia, school yearbooks, obituaries, military records.
A lot of military records.
Yeah, there and other kinds of records might be around that would be helpful. You try to find people who might have known him or to find the sons or daughters of people who might have known him well. You look for veterans groups. They're online frequently. They're usually pretty easy to get to. They may have information. The 191st Tank Battalion provided me with other pieces of information that were very helpful. I gained a lot by trying to learn the context that Phil was in. It helped in so many situations, including these war contexts, to understand what he was going through and to understand some of the little bits of responses that I would find in letters or the bunch of responses in the diary to understand the context of those better. And I really got to know him through those kinds of things. I just urge you to get in there and do it soon push for this stuff and just keep digging. I had a lot of dead ends and I also had a lot of amazing things. We've picked on one amazing story, but there are others in the book that crossed Phil's path and that intersected with his life.
Well, it's been great to talk to you, Paul. Thank you so much.
It's been a great joy to be here. Thank you, Laura.
That's author Paul Levy. Again, his new book is called Finding Phil, Lost in War and Silence. This is The Exchange on NHPR.